United States against Stockett is our next case for argument. Mr. Daisy.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, William Daisy, I've represented Mr. Stockett at trial as his appointed counsel and continue that appointment on appeal. The case is before the Court on direct appeal, raising two challenges to the conviction. The sentence of 20 months has been fully served and is not challenged on appeal. Mr. Stockett first appeared on the radar screen after a arson fire of a Holocaust museum in Terre Haute. A young man named Ross came to the police, said, "Mr. Stockett has made anti-Semitic statements in my presence. He's sort of a drifter." He looked good to the police as a suspect in the arson fire. Mr. Stockett had been trying to sell a car for $450 to Mr. Ross. Mr. Ross was outfitted with recording devices and video cameras. He was given a gun, $400 in cash. He offered $400 plus a gun, purported to be worth $500. Mr. Stockett took the gun. He was arrested. He was questioned. His apartment was searched, and nothing came out of the arson fire. Mr. Stockett's prior felony conviction arose out of Oregon, and it was nearly 30 years old at the time of his arrest. Unsurprisingly, there were some elements of difficulty of proof at trial as to the existence that the prior felony conviction alleged by the grand jury in the indictment was indeed Mr. Stockett. The certified copies of conviction records offered and admitted without objection established that Joseph Charles Stockett was convicted of second-degree arson in Oregon in 1976. Mr. Ross, when testifying at trial, testified that Mr. Stockett had told him that he had been convicted of arson in 1975 or 76. My argument overall is that those facts laid up next to United States versus Allen do not establish facts from which a rational finder of fact could conclude that the Joseph Charles Stockett convicted in Oregon was Joseph C. Stockett on trial in this case. Oddly, Mr. Stockett took the witness stand. He was testified for the equivalent of 100 pages of the trial transcript and was not asked during that testimony whether his name was Joseph Charles Stockett, and was not asked if he had suffered the felony conviction alleged in the indictment. Allen, as the Court may recall, involved an identity of names, David L. Allen, both in the conviction record and the defendant as charged, and it involved fingerprint evidence that David L. Allen had been arrested on a probation or parole violation warrant issued under the same cause number as the felony which was charged. And we argued before the district court, and do here, that more laid up next to the Allen case than in the abstract, that these facts don't establish enough for a rational trier of fact to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the Joseph Charles Stockett, convicted of arson, was the fellow on trial before the court. We argue, moreover, in another argument, the argument that comes before the court under a plain error standard of review. It was not argued to the district court, but an argument under the Oregon law as it existed and exists that Mr. Stockett's civil rights were restored such that the conviction for arson would not prohibit his possession of firearms in Oregon. It's a somewhat obscure statute in that I don't believe it's ever been construed or even mentioned in an appellate decision, either federally or in the state of Oregon. It's a statute that provides that if a person has, and I think the operative language is, one felony under the laws of the state of the United States, and then as a good boy for 15 years or a good girl for 15 years following discharge from parole, that Oregon's laws prohibiting possession of firearms don't apply to that person. Oregon has always restored convicted felons' right to vote, hold public office, and serve on a jury following release from imprisonment. And pre-Caron, before the Supreme Court's decision in Caron, the Ninth Circuit was regularly holding that felons who possessed long guns did not violate 922G by doing so in Oregon for that reason. post-care, and that's a bad argument. But this 15-year statute by itself indeed acts as the final step in complete restoration of civil rights and the ability to possess a firearm. The question really becomes, what is the intent, or was the intent, of the Oregon legislature, which the courts have never fully explored, in using the words one felony under the laws of the United States? We point to Oregon's treatment in its recidivist statutes, excluding from consideration as a prior felony conviction court martials that described offenses denounced only by military law and triable only by court martial. And what I would suggest is the flip side of the same coin, excluding convictions by court-martial, or including as convictions by court-martial, only offenses that would have been a felony if committed in this state. Mr. Stackett, in the Vietnam era, in the Navy brig, suffered court-martial convictions for mutiny and a lesser, an offense which is considered a lesser-included offense, riot, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. If those convictions, those prior court-martials, would have been considered in Oregon an offense under the law of the United States, well, a felony under the law of the United States, then this argument failed. We argue that it would not have under the...
Well,
yes, sir.
Does Oregon define the word felony someplace? You know, most states define felony as a crime for which the penalty exceeds a year. Some states use 2 years as the dividing line.
I'm reasonably certain that 1 year is the dividing line in Oregon.
In
yes,
Oregon.
And
the penalty for mutiny by court, the court-martial penalty for mutiny certainly exceeds a year.
Yes, it's death by act of Congress. Death or such
Although
other punishment
that
as the court-martial
may imposed on your client.
May impose. Pardon me, sir.
That penalty was not imposed on your client.
No, blissfully so.
I don't know. We wouldn't be having this dispute if that penalty had been imposed.
Blissfully for Mr. Stockett, it was not imposed.
So
indeed,
why,
yes, sir.
I'm just putting two and two together. Court martial is under the laws of the United States. It's a felony because the penalty exceeds a year. What's left?
What's left, I argue, is a general Oregon statutory scheme that would exclude from, under definitions of prior felony offenses for recidivist purposes, exclude court martials that, as I said, were for offenses denounced only by military law and made triable only by only by court-martial. I would suggest that a civilian wandering through Oregon just can't commit mutiny. You can be uncivil to policemen, you can be uncivil to judges, but it doesn't amount to mutiny. The military world has an entire body of law that is centered on good discipline, good military order, and without which the military could not exist. Of course, when somebody says no to his commanding officer or incites his fellow soldiers to do something on a battlefield that is contrary to good military discipline, certainly Congress has entrusted to those tribunals the ability to try and punish those offenses. But Oregon, I would argue, in its overall scheme, doesn't include that sort of stuff in its conclusions that convictions...
Yes, sir? You're losing me. If Oregon said an offense under the law of the United States that is also an offense under the law of Oregon, then I could certainly follow it. But it doesn't say that. It just says an offense under the law of the United States. I mean, take California. California has legalized medical marijuana, but it's still a felony under the laws of the United States. Right? So if we had this same law in California and the conviction was for marijuana possession or distribution, I don't think there's any doubt that it would count as a felony under the law of the United States, even though the same conduct was not illegal in California. So why is this any different?
I'm probably not responding precisely, but it is different because Congress has decided that if your civil rights were destroyed in the context of a 922G case, if civil rights were restored under the law of the jurisdiction in which the conviction was suffered, then you haven't violated federal law, whereas there is no such built-in deferral to state law in the marijuana example that the court has delivered. I've saved no time for rebuttal, as I see, and would, with the court's leave, will retire. Thank you, Your Honor.
Turn to Mr. Daisy. Mr. Vaughan.
Good My name is Joe Vaughn, and I'm the Assistant United States Attorney who handled the prosecution of Mr. Stockett in the court below. When viewed in the light most favorable to the government, the evidence was sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Joseph Stockett was the Joseph Charles Stockett who had been convicted of the felony offense of arson in the second degree in 1976, as had been alleged in the indictment. There's no question in the case that Mr. Stockett was is a convicted felon. He made those statements on the audio video tape that he could not possess the pistol because he was a convicted felon. The question is, was he convicted of the felony offense set forth in the indictment? That alleged that Joseph C. Stockett was convicted of the felony offense of arson in the second degree in the Circuit Court of the State of Oregon for Lane County in a specific case number on or about March 31 of 1976. Mr. Stockett testified that he was Joseph C. Stockett. The government's proof of the prior conviction consisted of the indictment in the Oregon case, which alleged that Joseph Charles Stockett committed the offense of first-degree arson in Eugene, Oregon, in 1975. The judgment and commitment order in that case stated that Joseph Charles Stockett was convicted of second-degree arson on March 31 of 1976. The following evidence established that Mr. Stockett was that Joseph Charles Stockett. His name was Joseph C. Stockett, according to his testimony, same first name, last name as alleged in the indictment, and the middle initial of C is the first letter of Charles, which is that of the person who was convicted. Mr. Stockett testified, I think an inference can be fairly drawn from the evidence, that he moved to Oregon after he left California in 1975, and the arson in the Oregon case was committed in 1975. Mr. Ross testified that Stockett told him he had been convicted of the felony of arson in 1975 or 1976, and here the arson was committed in 75, the conviction was in 76. Additionally, I would submit that the offense of arson is a little bit unique as compared to other prior convictions for such offenses as burglary, theft, or of dealing in narcotics. I would submit from that evidence a reasonable jury could find that it was highly improbable that two different Joseph Stocketts were involved, and when viewed in the light most favorable to the government, that evidence was sufficient to permit an inference beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Stockett and the Joseph Charles Stockett charged in the indictment were one and the same person. This case is distinguishable from Allen, where the link...
Does any of this matter? That is, the argument with respect to prior convictions supposes that Stockett has a felony conviction. That is, he says, I was released in 1979 from this term of imprisonment exceeding a year, and so my 15 years under Oregon law expired in such and such a date. That you can't be released from a term exceeding a year unless you were a convicted felon.
Which you said he was.
QED. Why does one need to worry?
On the one hand, I don't think one needs to worry. However, and I don't recall a specific case at this time, but my recollection is having reviewed some cases saying that not only did there have to be the fact of a prior conviction, but it needed to be the prior conviction that had been alleged in the indictment. But the government's position is that the evidence, regardless of how it is viewed, is sufficient to establish that he is, in fact, not only a convicted felon, but he was convicted of this specific felony alleged in the indictment. Allen, that was based on simple commonality of names, where you had a defendant by the name of David L. Allen. You had a judgment indicating David L. Allen was convicted of the felony offense of dealing in cocaine in 1995. A post-conviction arrest warrant was issued for Mr. Allen on that judgment, and then the defendant is arrested in 1999. This court found that evidence was insufficient because there was no evidence from which the jury could find it was highly improbable that two David L. Allens were involved. I submit that in that case, had there been testimony that the defendant said, not only am I David L. Allen, but I was convicted of the felony offense of dealing in cocaine in 1995, that deficiency that was found by the court in Allen would not have existed. And that evidence is present in this case. Regarding whether it was plain error to have based Mr. Stockett's conviction in this case on his 1976 conviction in Oregon. Under Oregon law, Mr. Stockett's civil rights were restored. However, under the unless clause of 18 U.S.C. section 921A20, we looked to Oregon law to see if there was a separate provision that prohibited Mr. Stockett from possessing a firearm. Oregon's felon in possession statute, in fact, does that. Mr. Stockett does not fall within the exception of that provision because he has more than one prior felony conviction. He has the two prior felony convictions for riot and mutiny following a general court-martial, with under precedent going back to 1857, are under the laws of the United States. Therefore, Mr. Stockett does not fall within an exception. Oregon law precluded him from possessing a firearm, even though his civil rights have been restored. Therefore, he could not possess a firearm without violating 922G1. If there are no further questions from the court, the government would stand on its brief and would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Daisy? You must have 30 seconds left.
I would. If I have 30 seconds, I'll use it in the runner. Mr. Stockett will be proud of me for this.
I'd say this. There wasn't any evidence before the jury that Mr. Stockett said, "I was released from imprisonment after for a felony conviction." And the sufficiency of the evidence argument goes solely to that. Did the jury hear evidence from which mm-hmm. the jury could conclude that this man suffered the conviction that was alleged in the indictment? I thank the court once again for its indulgence.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Case is taken under advisement. Our sixth case.